Okay, everybody, we have a great show for you today. Vinny Lingham joins me for a solo dolo crypto roundtable. Sunny's out sick, but we chop up all the important news. Coinbase has been issued a Wells notice by the SEC. That leads to a big and final debate about whether or not I should make my first J trade to short a stock. Should I start short Coinbase? Well, you're going to find out at the end of the segment. And then we dive into the news that CZ and Binance are being sued by the CFTC. And we have a crypto sociopath update. Sam Bankman-Fried is facing over 100 years in jail because the indictments keep coming. He has now been accused of bribing Chinese officials. Wow, shocking. And then we wrap up with an amazing conversation about generative AI, how Vinny is building on top of OpenAI into his awesome startup, waitroom.com. And then we talk about the balkanization of different pools and different territories of data. Who's going to win shopping in AI? Who's going to win consumer? Who's going to win the enterprise, et cetera? And it's actually a pretty interesting discussion. And I talk about who might buy Reddit, Quora, and Stack Overflow. It's going to be a great show. Stick with us.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Pilot. Grow your business more sustainably and operate more effectively. Pilot provides the most reliable accounting, CFO, and tax services for startups and small businesses. Head to pilot.com/twist and get 20% off the first 6 months. OrgSpace. If you're a startup and you aren't building a performance culture, your competitors will eat your lunch. Get $2,000 of credits on pro plans with a 30-day free trial at orgspace.io/twist. And Issue is the all-in-one platform for creating and distributing beautiful digital content. Get started with Issue today for free, or sign up for an annual premium account and get 50% off when you go to issue.com/podcast and use promo code TWIST. That's issue.com/podcast and use promo code TWIST.
All right, everybody. Sunny Madra is out today. So feeling a little sick and under the weather, but I got Vinny Lingham here, and there's so much going on in crypto that the show must go on. Vinny, of course, Vinny's the co-founder of Civic, startup that encrypts identity information on the blockchain, and he started Waitroom, which is a one-to-one video conferencing platform. You can go check it out at waitroom.com. Sunny, this has been a crazy couple of weeks, huh? I'm sorry, Vinny.
It's going to be Sunny.
You know, my notes have Sunny at the top. Vinny, it's been a crazy couple of weeks here, and I think we had a week off in between, so.
Yeah. It's good to be back. And lots happening. Yeah, excited.
I guess in the crypto community, the SEC legal action, impending legal action, I guess would be the best way to say it, against Coinbase, according to the Wells notice that was issued last week. Is that the biggest news right now?
I think that, I mean, it's quite surprising for me for them to, you know, go after, you know, a U.S. regulated, you know, compliant entity in this way. But to be fair, they're going after everyone. So I don't think that, you know, I think Coinbase probably felt left out if they didn't go after Coinbase.
All right. So let's just tee up what happened here. The SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, sent Coinbase, which is obviously, as Vinny's correctly pointing out here, one of the largest and notable and legit players in the space, they sent him a Wells notice. And that's typically a notice that precedes a lawsuit. The notice was pretty unclear. According to Coinbase, it mentioned Coinbase Earn, Prime, its wallet, and certain unnamed digital assets. Coinbase responded with a blog post detailing the U.S. government's uneven enforcement and lack of guidance. That's been a theme Brian Armstrong's been on for a while. Hey, can I come in and talk to you? And they're like, yeah, you can come in, but the meeting never seems to happen. So who's right, who's wrong in this situation? Is it Coinbase for innovating and taking risks and pushing the envelope? Or is it the SEC for not being clear, other than to say, hey, the rules exist, follow the rules? Where are you coming down on this in 2023?
Look, my take on it, it's pretty simple. Like, I think that they both have good arguments and good points. I don't think I wouldn't be able to side with either of them right now if I was a judge. I'd have to look at the facts. I think that there's a lack of regulatory clarity, as Brian correctly points out. Like, the SEC's jurisdiction, what they're going after, And I do know that, that Coinbase did run a whole bunch of things through the SEC, and at some point, someone in the organization, you know, greenlit listings, etc. So there's a lot of back and forth. It's really hard. I mean, you need to look at the facts of the case, and yeah. I mean, I think it's actually a healthy thing that this is happening now, that the SEC puts together a lawsuit and goes to court, and you know, both sides fight it out, and it takes a year or two to resolve whatever. Let's get this done. Let's get it put behind us right now.
Got it. And to be clear, there's not a legal filed action yet.
No.
There is this imminency that this is coming any moment that both sides are sort of kind of saying. And if you look at Brian's tweet storm, I don't know if you saw that, Vinny.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
But my point is this, okay? Until there's actually a legal precedent that's been set by a judge at like the highest court level we can get to on this topic, then... You know, like once that's resolved, then it kind of gives us clarity. So the outcome here is we get clarity one way or another. And at least it's a judge making the decision based upon the facts versus one agency saying we have jurisdiction, this is wrong, versus another agency. If CFTC is going off to Binance, like there's all these agencies involved. Who has jurisdiction? What's the clarity? And so I'm actually looking forward to, and I know it's not great for Coinbase in the short term. But I'm looking forward to what the actual ruling is going to be and the substance of that ruling, because that basically puts the other agents. I mean, if the SEC loses this case, it's going to be a really tough one for them to go after other exchanges and et cetera. So,
and the XRP case is still ongoing, and that's years in. So now this is going to get resolved.
Yeah.
It looks like and mitigated through the courts, and that will force some, clarity. And if I guess the two possibilities are follow the existing rules, in which case crypto as we know it is kind of DOA in America. If they say, hey, just the existing rules are what you need to follow.
This goes back to the previous point we had on previous talks, Jason, on previous shows. Like, what country in the world runs the global regulations for crypto? There's nothing. Yeah. Like, everyone has their own rules. And so you have to play by rules in each country. The US has got a certain set of rules governed by the SEC, the CFTC, and whoever else. And there's still no clarity there. Switzerland's been the most progressive because they've actually created a set of rules that companies can abide by. I think it's a very dangerous situation we have in the US where we're pushing entrepreneurs out, especially in frontier sort of technologies, and not just in crypto, but even in banking, right? So why would you bank in the US when you can't trust your funds if a bank goes under? Like, we have those issues, right? We had that conversation. Yep. So we have to be very careful. America was founded on entrepreneurship. That was it. It was like people coming here for a better life and want to create businesses.
In the early days of a startup, you need to be focused on your product and your customers and how they use your product. But please don't forget about getting your accounting dialed in. As an early stage investor, I've seen so many accounting horror stories that have literally sunk a startup. And these were startups with great founders, great teams, great products, great customers, but their accounting killed them. Why? Because they didn't know the difference between accrual-based accounting and cash. And if you don't know the difference between that, that's okay. You can learn it. But I've also had different startups forget to do their tax returns, maybe paying without a proper payroll system in place. This is serious stuff that you have to get right. You're going to get it right in the case that your startup is successful. So you might as well get it right from the start. I could literally go on for hours. But when you're a founder, you have to balance not forgetting to set up a proper accounting system while also not getting distracted by trying to hire a CFO. All of these things, right, are on your mind. And there's one simple solution for all of that. It's Pilot. It's an amazing service provider. They provide accounting, CFO, and tax services for startups. They're really focused on startups. And any problem you're going to have, Pilot's seen it 100 times. So let them handle your books when you start out. And when you're big enough, you can hire a CFO, no problem. And you can bring all your accounting in-house. Pilot is here to help you until you get to that point. So Twist listeners can get a 20% discount for the first 6 months at pilot.com/twist, pilot.com/twist. That's pilot.com/twist for 20% off your first 6 months. So with this, we get the overall point. We want entrepreneurship and innovation to happen here, but there are protections for consumers. And a lot of crypto, in terms of how fast it moves, and, sort of the entire point of it is that it's available to everybody that it could be trustless, that it could be decentralized. A lot of like just even the concept of decentralization.
That's rhetoric and narrative. You know that. Yeah. Like most of crypto is a grift.
Right. But I mean, so just that central, the idea that it needs to be centralized and it needs to follow securities law and it needs to be accredited investors and it needs to have
periods. We just need clarity. We just need the SEC.
But on a practical basis, then these crypto projects would move slower and they wouldn't be able to be distributed the way they are. So you would take out a whole swath of decentralized.
No, that's not true. That's not true. I don't believe that's true. I believe that you could have a world where, based upon the set of circumstances, like for example, when a coin is created, what's the emission schedule for founders, investors, what's the minimum requirements, how is the coin mined, what type of model you use, burn and mint equilibrium, what, you know, because like the issue is this, okay? You get these pump and dump groups from all over the world sending these Telegram rooms. They go, oh, today we're going to pick on coin XYZ and we're going to pump that coin high and then we're going to dump it before our followers figure out we're doing this. And they have, or everyone else jumping on the train, loses. So it's like, this is penny stocks, by the way. This is the 80s and 90s, like, you know, even early 2000s. This is the penny stock game. And the SEC sort of clamped down on it and got stricter with it. We probably need a situation where there are less coins listed in the US. Okay. Mm. So the more legit coins would be here. The less legitimate coins would be, you know, on other exchanges, Binance, whatever. But we need the regulatory clarity. Like my one criticism of Coinbase, you know, I would say I don't have a lot of criticism on Coinbase, but the one I have is that they do have too many coins listed. Stuff that's just terrible. And they have had issues with some employees who are doing sort of front running with their cousins and all that stuff. So they've got a bit of tarnish there. Now, every company at scale has problems. They've got that problem. I think that like the US consumer, when I look at these coins, I wouldn't buy, and I'm a sophisticated crypto guy, I wouldn't touch 80% of the coins just on Coinbase. The 20% that's there are really, there's some really good stuff that you should buy and hold in your portfolio. But why are these other 80% there? I don't get it. And I don't see why.
Well, I think it was during the boom. If you don't have a coin that's hot this week, then there's 10,000 people in that pump and dump room.
Exactly.
They want to open an account and they want to trade it and they're going to just pick, you know, Kraken or Binance or some other exchange to, and they'll sign up for that. So it kind of put the gun to Coinbase and said, if you want, you know, people who want to trade on your platform, they're going to want to trade speculative stuff and they're adults. And I think Armstrong's a bit of a libertarian. It's like, I think he believes it's your money, you can do what you want with it, which many of us believe to a certain extent.
That's fair. That's fair. But I think that just the audience that they tap into is not, you know, like it's not entirely like, you know, high end sophisticated crypto people. It's average man on the street.
That word keeps coming up is sophistication. Yeah. And I think that's at the core of all this is.
And maybe certain coins, you have to have some sort of a license to trade them or something. Maybe like a Series 7 equivalent for crypto. Like you do this simple course and therefore you can evaluate, make your own decisions. And then if you have that certification, you trade whatever you want. Look, the guys at Coinbase, there's some super smart people there. They're very thoughtful about what they do. But I do think that, you know, the challenges that they have is they've got to compete with Binance and other exchanges around the world. And if you don't allow your customers to buy the coins there, they email, they complain, then they go somewhere else and you potentially lose those customers. I get the business risk of not having them.
I think you nailed it again. You know, it's obviously the level of sophistication a person has matters in all of this. And that is the clearest, easiest, most American path to resolving all the issues in crypto and in private market investing. We could change the entire system to be, instead of limited, to be unthrottled for people who have certain education levels. You can get a license for skydiving, or you can get a license for scuba diving. If somebody dies scuba diving and they have licensing, you know what we say? That's a tragedy, but they knew what they were doing. They knew the risks and they jumped out of a plane, or they went 100 feet under the water with an air tank with no ability to get to the surface in time without the use of that tank or somebody else's. And that really is the analogy here. Just make everybody sophisticated. If you want to have a license for a gun, skydiving, scuba diving, whatever it happens to be, diving into crypto, get yourself licensed and then you hold up your license. Listen, I know that this is a coin. I know that this is a speculative project and I don't even know who the founders of it are. I want to YOLO it. Screw it. I'm making a bad bet, you know?
Agreed. I mean, it's the same as casinos, right? Or playing poker. Like, no one stops you from going into the Aria and slamming down $100,000 and playing poker with Phil Hellmuth.
No. And he's going to get that money at some point. So I was thinking, this is the moment that crypto is crashing in America. There was that Operation Choke Point blog post.
2.0.
And then there's the, I guess, Katie Hahn did an article that kind of was similar to the 2.0 article in the Wall Street Journal. So when we're looking at this choke point, do you think it's going to be hard or very hard or impossible possibly for Americans to buy Bitcoin and other coins? It's going to get harder and harder, isn't it? Here in the U.S.
Yeah,
it's gotten harder.
This is the whole like wrench in the spanner for Balaji. Okay. Wrench in the spanner, a spanner in the works for Balaji. It's like, the problem you have is if Bitcoin rises too quickly and becomes a threat to the U.S. dollar hegemony, they're going to cut off the ramps. It'll be so simple. It's like any bank touching any exchange, you're going to like the price of Bitcoin in the U.S. rises and falls with the demand for selling and buying based upon U.S. dollar to Bitcoin conversion rates. That's it. And so if all of a sudden Bitcoin rose to $100,000, $200,000, but the banks cut you off, it'll collapse because people will try and sell, get their dollars out. Now, yes, there's some hyperinflation sort of argument there, but I'm not, you know, I think the 90-day period for Balaji was, you know, maybe a little bit too ambitious. I think he's going to lose his $2 million that he's put up.
Well, obviously, and, yeah. I mean, we're I think, I don't know how many days into the bet we are. I'm sure somebody met
2 weeks, I think, maybe. Or we'll
probably have this, probably like a Balaji loses $2 million.com counter or .io counter.
Yeah.
But somebody made, but it's sideways, I basically. It. I think he made the bet at 26. It's 28. Yeah. So he's got a long way to go. He's going to lose the $2 million.
I don't see it, Jason. I don't see how the government is going to allow Bitcoin to soar to $1 million.
Right. And so the U.S. government has been shutting down or taking
these legal.
Not just
the U.S. government. Hold on. Not just the U.S. government. So let me tell you what happens. The bankers and so. So basically, there's a correspondent network of banks across the world. You have SWIFT codes, you have IBAN numbers, whatever. If the US decides to ban Bitcoin and you have a bank in whatever, Portugal, Europe somewhere that touches Bitcoin or to Bitcoin transactions, they cut you off from the correspondent banking network. So then you will be isolated. You won't be able to send wires to US bank accounts. You will be able to move money around. And so the U.S. is a very powerful in the banking world, obviously. And so they can cut off the on-ramps and off-ramps. Like,
do you believe like this is already started? Do you believe the actions by the SEC is because the U.S. specifically does not want consumers, especially in a panicked, jittery market like this, during a recession, rising interest rates, bank runs of certain flavors going on? Do you think the U.S. government actually now is saying, let's not have an off-ramp, let's not let people off the off-ramp, let's start to unwind the off-ramps? Because that's part of Balaji's argument is like, the clock's ticking and you have a certain amount of time to get to Singapore or wherever, like, is the most, the Zug or whatever.
Yeah. No, it, look,
it's kind of reinforces what he's saying.
Okay, running a startup, it's like being a small market baseball team, right? You're trying to compete against the Yankees or the Dodgers. And if you want to compete, you need to be efficient. You got to play Moneyball, right? You've all seen the movie or read the book. Well, one thing that startups haven't really had access to until now is detailed scenario planning. And you can do this so easily with Workspace. It's people software, basically, for software people. It lets you create plans for deploying your capital intelligently and then adjusting your headcount based on different scenarios that will occur in the future, right? Because you can make a plan, but why not make multiple plans, right? And if you're watching this video, you can see an incredible demo here in the background. What if you raise a $10 million Series A? What if you can't raise it all? What if you only raise 5, 7, 3? Okay, what if you pivot to generative AI? How do you redistribute your talent? Do you need as many people? Do you need more people? Do you need different types of people? Are you doing this kind of granular planning? Are you being this thoughtful? Well, you should be, okay? You can plan for everything from the hyper growth that we're all trying for, or regrettably, the rifts that sometimes we have to do, and anything in between. And here's the best part. Twist listeners can get $2,000 in credits on OrgSpace's pro plans with a 30-day free trial at orgspace.io/twist. That's orgspace.io/twist. Go try it out, prepare your company, and just be sophisticated, because when you want to go raise money or you want to hire great people, they're going to appreciate that you've done this. Try orgspace.io/twist today and get $2,000 in credits.
There's a lot of convexity in this whole process. Like, you don't have a situation where it's going to run up to $1 million because everyone's trying to get, and it's going to stay there because the ramps are cut off. I mean, the argument would be that there's extreme hyperinflation in the US dollar. So if Bitcoin's up 50x, gold should be up, you know, some number multiple than that as well. Maybe gold.
But hyperinflation is 50% month over month.
That's what he's expecting.
That's insane. Year over year was single digits, right? At the peak.
Well, I think hyperinflation is 10%. I think it's a little lower.
The definition I saw online.
What is Balaji's definition of hyperinflation?
I mean, if you're betting you're going to $1 million from 26,000, 40x in 90 days.
It's like 300% a month.
it's pretty, here it is. Hyperinflation, simple definition from World Economic Forum. It refers to a situation where the price of goods and services rise uncontrollably over a defined period of time. In general, the term is used when the rate of inflation increases more than 50% a month.
Okay, so even if it did that, Balaji's bet would be good because the price of Bitcoin would increase disproportionately to the rate of inflation.
Well,
so what he's saying is hyperinflation would trigger a run on Bitcoin.
Well, we could do this right now. 26,000 hyperinflation, 50%.
No. 50% would be increasing the monetary supply in the US of the dollar by 50%, which is, I think, $80 trillion worldwide. So that would be like 120. So you go from, you know, but that's M2 money supply. Mm-hmm. Even if you look at a smaller measure of money supply, a 50% increase could easily push Bitcoin from 500 billion to a couple of trillion dollars. Do I think it'll go up 50x to 10? Balaji is basically saying Bitcoin goes from 500 billion to $10 trillion.
You're talking about the market cap, not the price.
Market cap.
Yes.
But that means the price has gone up 20x as well.
Of course. Yeah. You're saying the market cap of 500 billion.
40x.
Yeah. 500 billion will be 40x. I mean, it's crazy.
So but then you have to believe that gold is going to run at the same rate. First of all, the money printed needs to come from somewhere. We've got a whole bunch of debt. We've got a whole bunch of free flowing money out there. We've got high interest rates right now. They would have to turn on the money print. So Balaji's bet, if I understand this correctly, it's this. He's basically saying the government is going to have to turn on the money printers in an absolute emergency crisis and bail out trillions of dollars in the banking system in the US and globally, which would contribute to 50% plus inflation in a given month, which would then basically push the price of Bitcoin up to $1 million. It's an intelligent and plausible argument. Is it realistic? I'm not sure.
I love the fact that he actually makes an argument and that he makes a detailed argument and he makes a bet. It's got us all talking about it.
If the money printers go brr, he's not wrong.
It's a stupid bet if you look at it because you can always hedge it, right? You can buy a couple of Bitcoin and hedge it. So it's a dumb bet.
Here's what I did. I bought some Bitcoin call options for end of June. I'm like, look, if Balaji is right, by the end of June, a 50K strike price will be nothing. So I bought 50K strikes. It cost me, I think, $300 per Bitcoin option. And if Bitcoin goes to 100,000, my $300 becomes $50,000 because my strike's 50. So like, that's a way better payoff than anything else. I bought a couple of those. I'm like, okay, let's sit on these for a while and see what happens.
Was it $300 per Bitcoin?
Yeah.
So for $300, you have the option to buy a Bitcoin for 50K.
Yes.
At the end of his bet.
At the end of June. At the end of his bet. Exactly.
If it's 51K, you buy it, you make $1,000.
I make three extra money. If he's right and it's $1 million, it's insane. Okay. But even if he's wrong and it's 100,000, I'm still making 50K on a $300 bet. That's how I play the market.
Well, I mean, it is long odds this is going to happen.
And I did it because Balaji, he called COVID. He's smarter than most people I've ever met, you know, and he's smarter than me, in my opinion, as well. So, he's like, I think he's a super smart guy.
I do think there is something for people who are super smart that they can see the improbable event.
Yeah.
And then highlighting an improbable event is a great way to get a massive amount of attention. Now, I'm not saying this is his intent.
Oh, sure.
But the cynical person would say, hey, if you took the long bet that like, hey, there's aliens, and you say there's aliens, and you're right, and Area 51 has aliens at it, and it comes out, or the CIA killed you know, Kennedy, and, you know, it was the Russians and the CIA, whatever, and you turn out to be right, wow, it's a big payoff. Which is the non-consensus bet. You bet on Uber or Airbnb or Coinbase as an angel investor, you get the non-consensus return. So I get that. And I didn't like the part about his bet where he didn't disclose his percentage net worth exposure, because I have a feeling he has so much exposure to Bitcoin that if it goes up, you know, 10%, it covers his bet.
That's possible. Yeah. I don't think that's, I mean, knowing Balaji, and you know, I know him, I don't think that way he would, I don't think he would do it for that.
I don't think he would do it for that, but it would be a nice way to have the bet be meaningless.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would net out the bet. Just like if I was taking the bet with him, I would buy 3 Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But if it does hit a million,
everyone,
I'm covered.
Everyone can participate in the Balaji side of the bet, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I did. I'm like, for an insignificant amount of money per Bitcoin, I can basically ride on what Balaji is telling me. And if I lose, if he's wrong, and it doesn't even go over, break 50K. You know, there you go.
Would you short Coinbase right now? Just their revenue has dropped. Okay.
I wouldn't. I at these levels, I think it's come down enough. I think Brian Armstrong's an extremely talented, smart guy. I think there's a lot of people at Coinbase who are really smart, and I would rather not invest at these rates than short. I mean, when they came out, I had bankers calling me from, you know, Goldman Sachs, everything else. Do you want Coinbase shares at these price? I'm at 200 and something. I'm like, no. I'm not buying it. I said to them, I'd rather buy Bitcoin at those prices because I feel it's a safer sort of risk-adjusted bet. Because if Coinbase goes up, it's because Bitcoin's rising, everything's going crazy, and I make money there. But if it tanks, Bitcoin will still have some value, and Bitcoin outperformed Coinbase since IPO.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the company's got $3.4 billion in long-term debt. They have $5 billion in cash, I believe, or $4.5 billion in cash.
Again, if Balaji's right... The shit goes through the it goes crazy, right?
Right.
And everyone starts going to Coinbase and trading and buying Bitcoin and stuff. And the next thing you know, Coinbase market cap is up 5x. So I wouldn't take the short on this.
But if you look, their transaction revenue down 85% year over year. So the revenue is massively down.
We're in a bear market, and these bear markets turn. You're 12 months away from Bitcoin halving.
Okay,
Bitcoin
I get that.
But Bitcoin halving is in 12 months. If you look at the historical numbers, 12 months before halving, Bitcoin basically doubles in price almost every single time. And then reading up to the halving, it keeps moving. And then after halving, it goes to the roof. So on a 12-month view, I think you're going to see renewed interest in Bitcoin at the very least, maybe other cryptos as well, but Bitcoin and Ethereum.
There'll be a renaissance for crypto in the next year.
People are buying. Have you looked at jmbullion.com recently?
No.
Okay. So jmbullion.com basically is a place you can go to buy gold, silver, platinum physically. Okay. Uh-huh. And you can basically, you know, you can stock up on this stuff. Go try buying some 10-ounce gold bars, which are, you know, reasonably expensive, $22,000. And go and look at the, yeah, we can go there. Go to the gold bars.
There's your gold bar.
There you go. Yeah.
They're sold out.
Pretty much. So you can click on the 10-ounce gold bars. Then. Okay. They got these ones in stock. It's like varied ones. Pre-sale, out of stock. Like literally you can't get this stuff.
Mm. So people after the runs of the bank just decide, you know what? I need to have $100,000 of gold in my safe or my safety deposit box.
Exactly.
And I don't care that it's, you know, not going to earn interest. You know, if it rises, it rises. But yeah, I mean, people are scared.
Yeah.
And this always resets people's brains to say, what's my backup to the dollar? What's the backup to my bank account? You know, do I have gasoline? You know, this triggers the prepper in everybody. And the prepper mindset is, I think, an archetype that's been like put into our brains because of popular media, popular culture, and also history. So there have been times when societies have collapsed and whatever you could put in a backpack, that's what you got out, right? If you owned a real estate and you were fleeing, your real estate's worth zero, but if you had bought some diamonds and you could swallow them, you can at least have those. This is what's happened. People are in this crazy, you know, catastrophizing survivalist mode.
And Hollywood glamorizes as well. We watched Last of Us, and you're like, all of a sudden, did you watch the show? It was great, right?
Yeah, it's fantastic. Show. Yeah, but get some guns. Yeah,
get some guns, get some gold, like, get, you know, things to trade with. But, you know, it probably won't matter much. But here's the other thing, by the way. I think that the more likelihood is not Bitcoin. I think it's actually gold. And I'm a crypto Bitcoin guy. I think that gold becomes, if the US dollar goes through some sort of hyperinflationary period or something happens, any mm-hmm. part of the world, governments are going to start having to buy gold to back their currencies, because if America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold, like mm-hmm. it does. And so you can imagine if other currencies are starting to collapse. And the global debt to GDP ratio is 350% plus. 350%.
Right. I want to answer this question, though, about Coinbase. They are also burning net loss of, in Q4, net loss 557, Q3, 545 million. So their cash position was down almost 40% year over year from the end of 2021. They've got some debt, a lot of debt, and they have a $4.5 billion in cash. So this seems to me like there could be a cash crunch here. They do hold 861 million in USDC as well. So you don't think shorting it's a good idea because of the jockey, because of how good Brian Armstrong is, and because Bitcoin having, and because it's already been beaten down so much. That's your antithesis, I could summarize it back to you.
I think it's got the brand, it's got the distribution. They could cut costs pretty easily. They just need to kill some of the projects they're working on. They're trying to do too much. If they would just focus on being a Bitcoin crypto buying service, and maybe a couple custodian, other things.
Yeah. But you don't think the AWS stuff, like building a platform for people to build crypto on top of, is a good idea for them?
I think they've got too much R&D costs in a market that doesn't have enough adoption. So
interesting.
The money they're spending on engineers and stuff, and all, you know, Coinbase doesn't seem to want to partner with other companies as much to do stuff. They want to build it all themselves. They're very Apple-esque in their way, and they're burning cash. And if I was a Coinbase, I'd be like, look, just go down back to basics. First of all, you can't time these bear markets. You don't know when they end, but when they do end, they end violently, and there's a lot of revenue coming to the system. But you can also argue that they just want to invest for the future. But the problem with that is when the sentiment's down, adoption is low. When adoption is low, it's hard to build products, because if people aren't using your products, how do you actually build great products? Mm-hmm. So it's a very fine line. Mm-hmm. I would probably cut, if I was at Coinbase and things were getting tough, I would cut some percentage of them of the workforce, 20, 30, 40%, a lot of it from R&D, and just focus on basics, focus on customer experience, focus on the core business, and wait for the market to turn. And when the market turns, you can argue, well, it's too late. I'm like, not really. If you're lean and nimble as an organization, and by the way, I'd be pulling in AI everywhere into Coinbase. AI could save them so much money on contract auditing, smart contract auditing. Like, OpenAI is fantastic. And yeah, maybe it's not perfect, but you can actually reduce the workforce. I think because they've got such a high burn in terms of labor, they're actually in a good position to preserve themselves.
All right, Nick, I'm going to bring producer Nick on here, because I was talking to him with him about it yesterday. You can just do audio if you want, producer Nick. But you've heard my floating the idea, because I've been seeing so many people talking about it. Should you short Coinbase as Operation Choke Point becomes like acute or not? You heard Vinny, maybe not a good idea. What do you think, Nick? You're looking at this. Do you think there's some short strategy here? Or do you think Brian Armstrong is just so transcendent as an entrepreneur?
I think Brian's incredible. Where I would see the biggest risk factor is with them is, you know, if you just want to be an exchange, Vinny, I'm curious what you think about this, but transaction-based revenue is low-quality revenue. It's completely spiky. It's totally dependent on what the market sentiment is at the current time. And just like Robinhood, since Robinhood went public, they've basically been trying to diversify away from transaction-based revenue, away from payment for order flow. Obviously, Coinbase doesn't have that kind of revenue. But don't you think that they need to find somewhere else? Like, I thought the Coinbase Cloud idea was a good upsell to investors. Like, hey, we're trying to do something better here that can be a little bit more lasting long-term and can be a little bit more resilient in a downturn.
Vinny?
I mean, right now, literally my entire thesis is based upon the fact that we're on the verge of a crypto melt up.
Melt up?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. Balaji's not wrong. Okay. We're peaking at the end of the interest rate cycle. There's not much more up. How much more are the Fed going to raise? 25 max. Okay. So the rate cycle's peaked. The quantitative tightening's not working, clearly. Okay. Banks are under strain. The money print is probably going to go on again at some point, probably soon. Whether it will get us to $1 million Bitcoins remains to be seen. But any movement by the Fed in the next month or two to loosen monetary conditions, even not through interest rate drops, just through, you know, quantitative easing on some level, is going to push the price of crypto up.
Absolutely. Mm. But in a melt up, what's the incentive to buy Coinbase if you know that they have no downside protection against people getting uninterested in crypto again? Like, where does an institutional investor ever want to buy Coinbase?
I go back to Bitcoin and fewer coins. I think fewer coins on Coinbase lists would improve liquidity, would improve
and give some downside protection for transaction volume.
Yeah, exactly. Because I honestly I don't think they make much money on all the other coins anyway. I don't think it's like, I think if you do the math, they probably don't make as much. Like Bitcoin, they trade $500 million a day in Bitcoin on Coinbase. Mm. Let's say they're taking 1% of that. They're making $5 million a day on just Bitcoin trades right now. Now that could easily become, I mean, but just by comparison, Binance does $4 billion a day.
Yeah.
Now, you know, so my view would be like, how do you get more Bitcoin trading going? How do you get more Ethereum trading going?
All right.
How do you get, you know, like, how do you get people to focus on the stuff that's actually going to have some long-term value?
I guess this is like, instead of shorting, you could just buy some puts, Nick, for 90 days or 100 days out from here.
I don't want to short Coinbase, by the way. That was your thesis. That's not my thesis.
No, I know. But if you were, you could just, you could buy a series of puts, 90 days, 120 days.
Jason, look, the market cap right now looks like it's like 14 billion.
Yeah.
You may have downside to, it may drop to like, let's say below 10, 7, exactly. So call it 7 to 10 million. But on the other end of it, this thing can get squeezed up. Mm. It can go double. It can go back to $120, $150, $200 a share. You know, I don't like the risk asymmetry. I will short something where I think it's got 80 to 90% to drop. I won't short something where it's maybe 30 to 50%. It's just the asymmetric risk doesn't make sense to me generally.
Right. This is the thing. If you have a qualified CEO, this has been a good discussion. If you have a qualified CEO, they're going to figure something out. That's the problem, in the shorting. If you short somebody who's a qualified CEO who got the company to here and they're good, like, he'll figure something out. So I think the short's off. If you are running a sales team, a design agency, or a media business of any kind, you know what a hassle one-pagers can be. You know what I'm talking about. They never format correctly. People are pigeoning, zooming on their phones. It's a disaster, right? And you have no tracking. You don't know if people are opening it, which page, which section they're most interested in. It's a complete mess. And there is a better way, and that better way is Issue, issuu.com. Issue is an all-in-one platform for creating and distributing beautiful digital content. It's not just for one-pagers, but you can create marketing materials of all kinds, magazines, catalogs, portfolios, all that great stuff. Issue has an amazing analytics dashboard, and you can see that if you're watching the video right now, and that will track reads, time spent, device breakdowns, and more. It also works seamlessly with tools that you already use, Canva, Dropbox, MailChimp, and InDesign. And if you're an e-commerce brand, you can make beautiful digital magazines and catalogs that evoke those emotions, inform people, and then get them closer to making that decision to buy your product. We are building a one page right now for our Angel Summit, which is happening in June. So you can get started for free. Or you can get 50% off an annual premium account at issuu.com/podcast and use the promo code TWIST. So there's two things you need to remember. First is the URL, issuu.com/podcast. And then I need you to remember that promo code TWIST. Thanks again to Issue for supporting This Week in Startups and our mission here to inspire innovation and to support founders. All right, speaking of Binance, they were sued by the CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So this is on Monday. So now we have two of the major exchanges, both having legal action taken against them, or a saber rattling with the Wells notice, I guess would be a better way to say it. So the CFTC filed a lawsuit against Binance, seeking a permanent ban on Binance and its CEO, CZ, famously on the Twitter, from U.S. markets. This is important because Binance is the largest crypto company in the world, even bigger than Coinbase itself. Binance trades $4 billion worth of Bitcoin per day. Coinbase does around $500 million, so it is significantly larger. So that would be about 8 times, right? Just that one currency alone. So who knows if that's representative of the whole business, but it's probably indicative of that. Quote, Binance has instructed its employees and customers to circumvent compliance controls in order to maximize corporate profits, according to the allegation. Specifically, the suit claims Binance instructed its U.S. VIP customers on the best methods for evading compliance controls. And then they claim Binance covered it up. How? By communicating with customers through, quote, a messaging application that was set to automatically delete written communications. Signal, probably. According to the complaint, the reason Binance used that communication method was to avoid leaving any evidence of their efforts to retain US-based customers. There were other allegations, including not requiring customers to provide any identity verifying information before allowing them to trade and facilitating derivatives transactions without registering with the CFTC. Binance argues it made efforts to operate legally in the US by setting up Binance.us, an affiliate that offers fewer crypto products for American users to comply with regulators. This is similar to FTX, set up FTX.us for separate as a separate US-focused entity. All right, post-lawsuit, unconfirmed reports of upwards of $2 billion in outflows from Binance. We're checking that, but that's the back channel. So what do you think about this one, Vinny?
This is another one where I think, you know, I actually like the fact that the regulators are getting involved and taking this to court, and let's see how it plays out. The reality is that if they've got evidence that there was wrongdoing, they have a right to prosecute, and, you know, the courts will look at it. Like, I'm a big fan of, like, let the process run itself out. I mean, you can make accusations all day, but if you have proof, if you have testimonies,
it looks like they have proof. And so just looking at, let's assume they wouldn't take this on if they didn't have what they thought was a 90 plus chance. Like, usually these folks do not take these things on, whether it's the Southern District of New York or any of these places. They don't take it on unless they have a slam dunk case, because they have so many cases they could take on. They start with the slam dunks and then they work backwards. So this is probably like a 98%, I would put it at, is like they have the goods here on them. Because they're even talking about how they, in this complaint, they're basically explaining how they did this communication to get US customers to circumvent, you know, who knows if that's VPNs or offshore accounts. But if they did do that, that's exactly what the US government is trying to avoid, is people circumventing KYC, circumventing the rules. So this would be disastrous. This could result in a ban. If you're trying to explicitly break the rules and then cover up worse than the crime, that means the government will assume you're a bad actor and that you're actually trying to circumvent the law because you tried to cover it up and they have you trying to do it. It wasn't like a one-off thing. It was a conspiracy, in other words. So how could this affect Binance's business?
Where do you think all the bad traders from FTX went?
And when you say bad traders, do you mean not good at their job traders or bad actor traders?
Bad actor traders. They went to all the other exchanges outside the US. They didn't go to Coinbase.
And so they didn't go to Coinbase. They went to Binance. And Binance, I guess, is fast and loose with these things. So we're back to the F around, find out kind of moment. Is that what's happening in crypto?
I don't want to make any accusations to Binance or anyone else. I'm just saying.
Well, if this was true, this feels like
it's
a really
true,
stupid thing to do.
No one condones criminal activity in crypto. no one legit condones it, right? So I think that all criminal activity should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
And just so to pick up, you know, like the outflows, a little bit of web research. Basically, lawsuit made public Monday. And by Monday night, there had been around $2 billion plus in outflows just on the Ethereum blockchain, according to the Wall Street Journal. Binance has $63 billion in the exchange's publicly disclosed wallet. So not a de minimis amount of money here, a couple of percentage points.
I think Binance and Tether kind of exist outside the US you know, purview. And so they can do whatever they want. And until the US actually steps up to go after them, they're going to continue to operate. So, you know, I've seen this happen with Tether for nearly a decade now. And so I'm just used to the idea that the US has got limited range in terms of what it can do.
Jurisdictionally.
And therefore, you know, it's the world we live in. Now, if obviously that changes, then, you know, great. But we got to just be, I'm just trying to be practical. I've just kind of lost patience in a lot of things and just saying
it would be great to just get all this behind us. So I kind of like your approach of, like, let's take the medicine. Anybody doing anything wrong, let's figure out what's wrong and then let's set the standard. Speaking of jurisdictions, Sam Bankman-Fried received
my favorite
indictment.
This is my favorite segment.
this week in Sam Bankman-Fried's frauds, he received a third indictment. I think they call these superseding indictments. You know, indictments that come after the original one, this time for allegedly bribing Chinese officials. It just
really,
if there was a crime.
Come on. A guy of his pristine
really, of his moral and ethical compass, he would literally drop the bag. and kick it across the floor. He put the bag on the Lazy Susan and spin it around in the Chinese banquet table with the gun under the table. I mean,
this guy's
like a Bond villain. It's like, it's Indiana Jones, you know, in the Temple of Doom opening scene.
He tries to act so innocent the whole time. I've never seen a guy put on such a, like, it's a fuss. It's like
the whole effective altruism thing.
Yeah.
I heard that effective altruism thing where like, is it better to stop the suffering of a billion worms versus one human? And if we could have less birds eating worms and we could make hawks into vegans, they wouldn't eat our puppies and chipmunks. I was just like, this effective altruism seems like such a load of bullshit for dorky guys to try to be impressive. And I was just like, and I'm sure they have good intent. I'm sure that it started in effective altruism in some good way. But when someone like, someone as conniving and as Lex Luthor as Sam, bank run fraud.
Sociopathic. I mean, the guy is
when the
nuts.
Sociopath gets their hands on something like effective altruism, it's like Hannibal Lecter getting his hands on, like, I don't know, a cooking school. And it's like, I can go to cooking school and eat my fellow, you know.
Christian Bale from American Psycho. It's like,
it's literally like getting him a hi-fi stereo.
He's like a vegan.
Hi-fi stereo? This could be fun for a year.
It was crazy.
Here's what happened. Prosecutors are accusing him of conspiring to bribe Chinese government officials. I'm shocked that Chinese government officials could be bribed to regain access to $100 to $1 billion in frozen crypto. So he kept trying to release this crypto according to the accounts. He authorized Alameda employees to pay the bribes in two installments to free up their accounts. In addition to this charge and the fraud charges from before, he's also under suspicion of violating U.S. campaign finance laws. That's not good either. In total, he faces 13 charges. So I guess this will be like his 15th and 16th life sentence. I've been saying it from the beginning, this kid's getting life, period, full stop. People tell me that I'm crazy, but he is going to be the He's the crypto Jesus now. He's going to, he's crucified. It's over for him.
I mean, like I said, like these, you know, like I said in the chat with you, how many more life sentences can this guy possibly serve? I mean, he's going to go to prison for a long time.
People thought he was going to get off. I don't.
I like, for me, the biggest like travesty is that he's sitting chilling out in his parents' home in Palo Alto waiting trial.
Seems so unfair, it's but like the, okay. Yeah,
like, and he had a $250 million bail, which no one actually posted. I don't get it.
You know, this is one of the great things about, when we have a high-profile case like this or Theranos, it can stress test our faith in the justice system. And I was delighted to see what happened to Elizabeth Holmes and Balwani, because they thought they could just run amok, move fast and break things, and take like this philosophy of speed matters and, you know, like, listen, if your app crashes, it's no big deal. And then they could apply that to blood tests. And this guy thought he could apply it to people's 401ks. This is deranged sociopathic behavior. You're taking a product testing experimentation phase for, you know, non-critical apps, and you're applying it to the most critical things in people's lives, their money and their health. Go to jail forever. I guess he can't use his parents' devices anymore, and he can only use his phone without internet access. And I think,
he was deleting signal messages as well. Like, I mean, after he, like a few weeks ago, like the guy is incorrigible. Like his moral fiber is,
it's like,
is
it's like some combination of Lex Luthor plus the Joker. Like, you just literally have to think of him as a sociopath, and then it frees your mind from trying to understand what he's doing. There's no rhyme or reason to this. It's just how much, you know, crazy shit can I do in reaction to what happens in the world? And, you know, I'm going to solve the problems by any means necessary. Speaking of sociopathic criminals on the lam, Do Kwon was arrested in Montenegro as well. I mean, who's left? It's just Tether that's left that we have a question about. Now, we don't know that Tether's done anything untethered.
No, but, so, I mean, my take on Tether has been I've been very frank about it for years. They were insolvent at one point. They were illiquid. They're probably not anymore because they cleaned up the act and Bitcoin went through the roof and they were holding some Bitcoin. So it's like one of those things where, you know, they played with house money. They nearly lost it all, but they made it back. But, you know,
they went on a good run.
Yeah.
That's our thesis. That's exactly. Our theory is that the Tether guys went on a good run. They were just out in the news talking about how they, you know, because they're just holding dollar for dollar, whatever they make on the money, they get to sweep. And supposedly they said they made like hundreds of millions of dollars last quarter, which is, you know, it's completely plausible. If you're betting with, it's kind of like Silicon Valley Bank taking people's money and then mm-hmm. going buying T-bills or whatever, they get whatever spread on top of it. And Tether, I guess, claims they had a good quarter. We'll see with these attestations, but man, yeah, congrats to them. they, how many people are investigating them right now, you think? Tether, how many open investigations?
I mean, it's the Southern District of New York plus a whole bunch of others. Look, Jason, it's very clear that the government's trying to clamp down on crypto. I mean,
yeah.
You have to ask yourself, why now?
Why now? Well, China did it already, right? China did it years ago.
But they did it years ago. Look at Signature Bank being taken out, right? They weren't illiquid. They weren't insolvent. And the FDIC is basically covering the losses because they can't touch the crypto business. Someone, I think Nick Carter posted a good tweet yesterday saying, you know, it's the responsibility of the FDIC to minimize losses to shareholders and taxpayers. Taxpayers are losing money because the banking system doesn't want them to sell, or FDIC doesn't want them to sell the crypto banking side of the business. So taxpayers have to foot the bill now.
I mean, that side of the business, money. Just like we saw Silicon Valley Bank or Bridge Bank was sold, like all the loans were sold. You're saying the crypto part of Signature has not been sold.
Can't be sold.
It can't be sold because
they didn't allow the buyers to buy it.
So there might be a buyer for it and they're just going to eat the losses on it. That's fascinating.
Yeah, because they don't want it to be banked in the US right now.
And so at the same time that
The question is why?
Well, the theory that you're alluding to is
they're trying to stop crypto.
They're trying to start crypto, but at this time is your question.
Yes.
And this is a time when crypto could be seen as attractive by a large populace of people who are looking at a banking system that they don't have faith in, the fractional one, and saying, well, fractional is fragile. What's anti-fragile?
Yeah, Bitcoin.
Shout out to Nassim Taleb from this psychotic, I don't know what he called me, psychotic something. Sociopath. Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory to think the US is saying, we have to clean up our own systems and make sure they're anti-fragile and they're, you know, solid. And we have to make sure that people don't run and we have a bank run to Bitcoin. So they're blocking Balaji's bet. I mean, do you think the FDIC and the Fed and all of these organizations are watching the Balaji bet and listening to these podcasts talk about it and thinking,
Probably not.
You think they're not aware of it?
Huh. They may have been flagged. They're not taking it seriously.
Gensler, you think Gensler's listened to the pods with, you know?
Maybe.
I don't know, people talking about
it. I don't think he's listening to us right now.
you've been playing with OpenAI since I have you here.
I have.
I had everybody on my team expense a GPT-4 account. Just so I'm like, you know, all 20 of you, go spend $20 each, spend the $400 a month playing with ChatGPT, and then take screenshots and put it back in our Slack. And then we're going to connect each person. This is my plan, is to have each person in the organization have like Jason GPT and then connect it, Zapier, into a Slack room. And then everybody in the company can watch each other's GPT instances and watch us use it to get inspired by the things we do with it.
That's pretty cool.
Which would be pretty cool, right? So I want to have a multiplayer ChatGPT for my organization. I would pay $100 per person. I would pay $2,000 a month, $24,000 a year. So if OpenAI or Microsoft are listening, to just put that all in Slack, or if it was in Teams natively, or if somebody can build this for me, I want to watch my team do these things and then have the AI aware of what each other are doing to inform them of it. So I could do a Slack message and say, hey, who would be great guests to have on our crypto roundtable to talk about these topics? And then Nick, producer, could see it, producer Brian could see it, the sales team could see it and say, hey, maybe we should do a series on this and get a sponsor specifically for it, whatever. So what are you doing with it?
So with Waitrum, which is my company, we actually just launched on Monday on Product Hunt. We got third place for a new product. Thank you. We've been using GPT-3 for about a year and a half, actually, to do transcriptions, summaries of meetings, etc. And thanks. And you click on the Waitrum AI, Nick. So we basically, I wouldn't call it a full pivot, but we basically moved the entire video conferencing platform into, it's effectively an AI-based assistant. So if you go to, so we have the basic conferencing, you can chat, you know, person on person, but imagine you've got this assistant in the background and you scroll down a bit more. Yep. And so now you're getting like bite-sized chunks, clips, automatic note-taking, AI-generated titles, summaries, tasks. So the assistant's always listening to you. So you can say, hey, we should set up a follow-up meeting next week, Wednesday, and it automatically has access to your calendar. It sets it up. It makes sure both people are available. These sorts of things. You can do, summaries. So you catch up is a good feature we're busy building. When you go late into a team meeting where you're like the 10th person joining, it's been going on for 10 minutes.
It gives you the bullet points of the meeting to date. Yeah.
Before you jump in, like this is what, Jason said this, Vinny said this, Nick said this.
I love that.
And you can go in. And then we email you all the meeting updates, the afterwards, the summary of the meetings, the clips that you can share.
Is weight room for business or for like business to consumer?
Focusing on business. We're focusing on business now. We started off on consumer a year ago, or like 9 months ago, and then we realized this wasn't. We actually a lot of people coming to us wanting to use it for business, so we've been pivoting towards the business space. And now
I like this idea of doing the office hours because I want to start doing this. So I'll try that, and then do daily stand-ups right now with huddles.
Oh, yeah, you should use this. And we have Slack integration as well. So you can share the clips back to the huddles into Slack. You should really try using this internally, Jay. I think it's a great product. The AI stuff it's in the next 30 days, we'll have more and more stuff out. We just launched. We're adding more and more all the time. But basically, we want to be an all-in-one AI-assisted meeting tool. So that's powerful because the existing meeting platforms out there, Zoom, everyone else, you have to go to a marketplace. You have to find the right app to plug in. Mm. We're building everything in natively. It's going to know you and your life inside out and all your meetings that you have.
It's amazing. Yeah, I'm going to sign up right now. So everybody go to weightroom.com and check that out. Really cool. So easy to sign up. One click with your Google, your Apple. And I'm going to do I want to do this office hours thing. And so I'll just do it in here and see how it works. And I'll make it public and people can just ask me questions.
GPT-4 is a huge step up. I mean, we started on GPT-3 like 18 months ago.
Yep.
It was good. It wasn't like, amazing. GPT-4 is incredible.
What would you say is the best part of it? Just better results?
I mean, noticeably better. I think the thing about GPT, so like if you go through GPT-3 0.5, the reasoning wasn't as good. Now it's insane. It is slower. And GPT-4 is way more concise. So, we've been doing stuff like real-time translation now. So, I can be speaking Japanese to you. You can speak English and we'll subtitle real-time the conversation. So, you can actually have calls there in any language. As long as you read the subtitles, you can handle it. In the future, we'll be able to do a lot more. But I think the world's moving quickly to using AI for everything. So, like Sachs has been going on about this as well on Twitter. I agree that the plugins, this OpenAI is going to change the world in so many ways.
Mm. What do you think of the plugin architecture and how quickly that's sort of forming?
I have mixed feelings on plugins. I'll tell you why, because I think that native integrations work really well. So maybe the term plugin is a bad word. If companies are taking OpenAI and they're building natively like we are at Waitroom on it, I think it's going to be amazing. If you're building like, and I've seen this already, like plug-in marketplaces and download this app and that app, it's always been a struggle. Even the biggest companies have struggled to get adoption in marketplaces for apps and extensions and plugins and stuff because compatibility is hard. But I think that the plug-in nature, like what Microsoft's doing with OpenAI is game-changing, right? It's Clippy on steroids.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally what we thought Siri would be able to do or Alexa, and you could ask it to weave things together and, hey, take this meeting that I just had and send the summary to this person and then ask them for their feedback on the discussion and come up with 5 questions to ask them and then vet that email from me first before you send it. And then I would see the email with 5 bullet points in it.
Exactly. It gets to know who you are. You can even get to a point where you could run for example, you could have a meeting in person and just run like a Waitroom app on your phone to record the meeting face to face with someone, send you guys both a summary of what happened, action items, follow up items, everything else. We're going to get to a point where what Siri was supposed to be doing is going to be done through OpenAI and third party applications. Now, never write off Apple. I'm pretty sure Apple is going to be coming in with some AI assisted something, Siri, whatever else, pretty soon. They've got their own AI internally, I'm sure. But I think Siri is going to be get an AI boost at some point.
It's pretty clear that this is going to be, you know, a situation where there's five or six of these ChatGPT competitors. And, you know, ChatGPT is the first and they're racing out ahead. But I don't know that they've run away with it. You know, it could be like Lotus 1-2-3 versus Excel. You know, who knows?
But the resources that Microsoft's given these guys. And the 100 million users they've got and the revenue curve and trajectory.
I'm not saying they're not off to a great start, but I was playing with Google Bard and it gave me ChatGPT 3.5 vibes as opposed to 4. Mm-hmm. And then Google has a lot more data than ChatGPT. So I'm super interested to see like what the data advantage, like just having YouTube only available in Google Bard and making it not available in ChatGPT. Just think about the corpus of data there. Yeah. Where I could ask it to make video clips or pull any videos that mention Dire Straits, you know, and the finger picking style of Mark Knopfler, what makes it unique, and write me a video essay about that. And it gave me a video essay of Mark Knopfler's style, right? And it could pull all of that data just from YouTube. Then it did the Play Store. And then anybody who's in the Play Store, and you know, it's just, it feels to me like this is going to be such a great competition. Then Amazon, the same thing with all their data on products. And if ChatGPT and Google can't use that product data, now you have Amazon, and you're going to be like,
100% right. This is going to split up into different segments. So let's talk about the segments right now. Who's going to own business to business? I think it's OpenAI and Microsoft.
Like enterprise
plugins, Slack, you know, Waitrom, all those applications that get built on top of it.
Microsoft would be number one.
Microsoft is going to win that, in my opinion. Yeah. Who's going to own consumer? Probably Google.
Yeah, Google would be likely, maybe.
Facebook did something, maybe they have some more data there, but who knows?
Facebook would be amazing because if you think about news and you think about trends and you think about fashion.
Shopping, Amazon's going to own shopping.
Amazon, they win that. Yeah.
You're right. It's going to split up into different... Balkanization.
And then you're going to need to have some glue between them to say, hit the Bard API. I need YouTube data.
Yep.
I think Quora's got a chance to be a big business to business. If I'm Microsoft, I'm buying Quora right now. If I'm Google, I'm buying Quora for $1 billion right now. That if I could buy Quora stock right now on the secondary market, I might actually buy it. I don't know what their valuation revenue is. It's very close to the best company. But I think Quora's data set and Stack Overflow's data set, those two data sets are suddenly going to... If I'm Microsoft, I'm buying those two companies. If I'm Google, I'm buying those two companies and I'm blocking any competitor from indexing them. And then Reddit needs to get taken out. So if you're Microsoft, Google, if you're Facebook, how do you not buy Reddit right now? You buy Reddit and you just have all that data and you block everybody else from having it in their AI models. No brainer.
You can probably get some Quora stock on Ford.
Maybe. All right, listen, this has been an amazing episode. Vinny, thanks for coming in. Sunny, feel better. Anytime. And we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jason. Cheers.